Treasure Shop of Maniacs, you're listening to another Corona episode of the Shop Doc Show. I'm Dave, still in my house, but still the same kid as Rupert. And with me is Chris, comfortable in that solitary booth choir.
Yeah.
How are you?
Yeah, same old another week in our places. Yeah, I'm doing okay. We got a special guest this week. Another kind of crossover show, because it's, I don't know, it's one of my favorite podcasts. I know you listen to it too, Dave, JS Party. We have Suze Hinton on. Hey, Suze.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I actually, like, again, fellow podcast host / panelist. Like, I've been a fan of Shop Talk for a really long time. So this is actually really fun to actually, like, kind of collide like this. Yeah. It's funny because I am actually recording JS Party immediately after this. So it's a double
Are you
podcast
really?
Day. Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's awesome. No, a true crossover episode. It's a great show. Everybody should listen to that too. It's actually literally my favorite tech podcast. That's not our own, because that's disqualified immediately. But I like the different formats and all that stuff. Really good. So, Suze, you're at Stripe right now, right? It's like not super new, but a little new.
Yeah, I've been there just over 6 months now. So that kind of awkward phase where you go from not understanding what the heck is going on at the company to, oh, I think I understand the company now. You know, it's that nice sweet spot that I've hit finally.
Nice. It seems from the outside, I mean, we know a couple of people at Stripe, but I largely don't know anything about the internals of Stripe. But from the outside, it feels very admirable company, like beautiful design, you know, APIs that developers just love, you know. Like, I don't know. I don't know anybody that is Stripe, gross, you know? Is that what inspired you to go there? Does it feel like that on the inside too?
Yeah, absolutely. I was working as a developer at Kickstarter years ago, and I was kind of responsible for that sort of weird bit where you click on a reward if you want to back a project and you want a reward to go along with it, and you're sort of picking things, and then that obviously goes
into... Oh, so kind of a big deal.
What I meant was that, you know, eventually you get to check out, and I did some work to do with that too, right? So it was sort of like the glue in between, you know, that campaign page and the actual checkout. And so, you know, if I went on run or went on call, you know, sometimes we just had weird payment things that had literally nothing to do with Stripe. It was the way that we were coding our checkout. And so I had to go and read the docs and familiarize myself with the API. And I was reading the docs and I was like, what is this lovely place that I'm in right now? You know, I think that the biggest thing that just blew my mind was that when I was reading the documentation, they put your test API key embedded in the code samples. So you can literally just copy paste and the stuff that you're trying out works. And that to me was the single moment where I was like, I will never be good enough to work at a place like Stripe, but it would be so good to work at a place where they think about the little details like this. So that was sort of my moment. And I think that was 2015, 2016. And then I started the job 6 months ago. So you really never know what the future holds. I feel very fortunate.
Isn't that incredible when something happens in your life and you think back and it's like, gosh, it wasn't so long ago where that felt so insanely out of reach.
It's so true. That's exactly how it felt.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I love that little touch, though. Yeah, looking at docs and seeing, you know, API code that is ready to go for you, not just for, you know, generic replace your API key, replace things that are relevant to your account, you know. That's like real cool dog fooding stuff, you know. I think, like, what if it, like, executed it, too, and you could, like, see the results? Maybe it does that, too. I don't know, but. Incredible. Very cool. Sounds like you're liking the job at Stripe. And the job is DX, they call it, or you call it. Who calls it that? Is that a thing?
It's a little complicated internally, actually, because we have this organization called Developers, which means developer audience. Does that make sense? Because, you know, Stripe has a bunch of products. They also have the dashboard. And so you can actually administer a lot of stuff without being a coder these days, whereas Stripe originally started just for developers and coding. So there's an organization called Developers. There's a different, you know, set of smaller umbrellas in there. And so I'm in the developer advocacy section, and that has crossover with everything from developer experience products, which is like specific tools that are adjacent to our Stripe APIs. There's a team that works on those. So that's the SDKs, the documentation, and we have tech writers and all sorts of other people underneath the developer's umbrella too. So I'm in developer advocacy, but that boundary is quite fluffy, and we sort of have a lot of overlapping teamwork with these other teams outside of it, you know, under the same big organization.
Right. So what would be like a key win for you in this role? Like, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, should we take this opportunity here on this podcast to tell somebody about something cool that Stripe does that they should know about?
I think, so my job has me writing almost a different programming language every week. I think that is, that's like a really good description of how, I guess how varied the work is. And so, you know, I spent all of January writing Go, and then just recently I've gone back to writing JavaScript and TypeScript again. But some of the things that developer advocacy does specifically at Stripe is we work on our engineering blog, as well as just like writing other blog posts out, you know, in other ecosystems such as dev.2 and other places. We help run our conference every single year. So we're providing a lot of the really cool demos that showcase like new products for Stripe. We also just do API reviews. So I actually prefer most of the internal facing work rather than the external facing work of advocacy at Stripe. And one of my favorite things to do is attend API reviews, where they're basically like hour-long meetings where somebody's introducing like a new feature of an API or a big breaking change or something like that. And we all sort of have our input and talk about, you know, some scenarios that people might not have thought of that we'll have to solve before releasing it and things like that. And so an example of that is there was a specific thing around type support in an SDK. And I very strongly disagreed with them shipping a certain thing. I just felt it wasn't ergonomic. And so I was able to negotiate, and then we actually unshipped that small portion of it. And so again, it's not supposed to be sparring or defensive or anything like that. It's just our first principles thinking of how does this feel for the user? And, you know, is it important to us more than the user's experience to have this specific thing, you know? And so that was a negotiation that happened, and I felt like that was a really big win. And so one of my favorite things is just building those relationships internally in order for us to advocate for developers, because we tend to talk to them on a regular basis a lot more than product teams get an opportunity to. So it helps us work with user research to sort of like carry, I guess, you know, the just carry the sort of message back to the product teams, you know.
Does it help? Does it help when you're new sometimes? Or you're like, you haven't been looking at the same code for so long that you could like see APIs that are like, whoa, what is that weirdness?
This actually was one of my favorite sort of months that I worked at Stripe, which was my first month, because especially if you're starting in the developers org, they encourage you to do a bunch of what we call friction logs, where you go through and you try to implement a bunch of products, and then you just write detailed notes. It's literally a play-by-play. It's just kind of word vomit, and then you clean it up, but you just write, oh, I wanted to do this, so I Googled this, and then I ended up at this link, and then I copied, pasted this code, and then I ran into this error, and then here's how I thought about how to solve the error. And you just keep going through, and then you end up calling out specific things that you think should be fixed. And sometimes you can just go through and pull requests yourself if you want. And so I really enjoyed that experience. A few things that I did when I went through friction logs was I ended up shipping an example app in a Docker container, because it took me far too long to set up, you know, a custom Ruby environment just to run the example app, for example. And as well as just like making some changes to other sample apps, as well as like some documentation changes too. And like when you're new and you feel that you're actually having an impact on the development experience immediately, that is such a nice feeling. And so Stripe gets so excited when new developers start who haven't had a ton of experience with Stripe. Like I hadn't touched it since 2015, 2016. So it was very, very cool for me to kind of see how the APIs had changed, for example.
Wow. Well, friction log is my favorite new thing I've ever heard in my life. Because
I'm gonna be a friction log consultant.
You could be.
That's what I want to do.
It's really fun. It's kind of like penetration testing, but it's for like the developer experience, right? You get to write up a report. Yeah, it's super fun.
About what's happening in your mind. You know, like those little logging those little moments of frustration or literally friction, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. I sent out a dumb tweet the other day. It was like, I'll pay me $10,000 and I will use your docs on Zoom with you. I don't know if that's an hour or what, but let's just pretend it's $10,000 an hour just because. But like, I think that's a really valuable service because, you know, if you're whatever, a big developer service, you know, like I'm thinking like hosting company, Netlify or Azure or whoever, you know, like and your developers are getting frustrated. They will be frustrated with your product like eternally. And then now you're building bad blood and community disrespect and all this stuff that like you're like make it break it is based on the goodwill of your API almost. Right. And I, you know, I'll charge. Yeah. Let me charge. I'll charge you money just to use your docs for you. And I'm a pretty good developer, but man, there are times where you just like run into things. You're like, I don't get it. I have to install like a Hugo app. I don't or a Go app to get this running. I don't understand. But yeah, there's like my favorite new one is where it's like, yada, 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 watch this 4-hour live stream. And you're like, I just don't have the time.
Check out our webinars. It's like, God, if you tell me that, they better be good.
Well, it's Tuesday at 7 p.m. your time, you know? So, great.
It's funny you mentioned that because I will admit that I get a little bit of free user research out of like, sometimes I'll be going through my Twitter feed in the morning and someone announces they're going to do a Twitch stream and they're going to like integrate Stripe into their website. And I'm like, oh, yes. Nice. And I get really excited and I tell everyone at work. And, you know, so if you do that on Twitter, I'm warning you, I'm going to put it in the dev advocacy channel at work because we're all going to watch. And we will just completely like ghost and lurk in the background and not help them because we'll just be making furious notes about like, what did they get stuck on? And like, did they make any mistakes? Oh, and are they aware that they made mistakes? Do they have confidence in their integration at the end? You know, things like that. And so that is a little bit of free research that I get sometimes, which is very helpful.
Incredible. Yeah.
That's like guerrilla research. Usually you have to pay for that. You have to like give somebody a Starbucks card or something.
Yeah, well, we give people shout outs in our newsletter. So we'll say, hey, you know, blah, blah, you know, Mr. Jones like implemented Stripe and showed subscriptions and they did a really great job. So we would recommend their approach. And then we will call them out in the newsletter and thank them. So.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Jetpack. Jetpack is a plugin for your self-hosted WordPress site. I have a bunch of self-hosted WordPress sites like CSS Tricks, and I think it's probably the most important plugin that I run. It's not a plugin that just does one little thing. Jetpack is just, it's like this huge feature set, and each one of those features is super useful. Huge things like it backs up the site, can back it up in real time, incredible. It'll warn you when your site goes down. It'll block spam from your comments, which is incredible. CSS Tricks probably gets 10 times more spam comments than regular comments, and largely I don't see it at all. It'll update your plugins. It'll add security features like people trying to brute force log into your website. It'll allow you to log in easier because it allows you to some single sign-on stuff from WordPress.com. That's the first tab of features from Jetpack, which is amazing. I think image performance is a super big deal on websites. I just use Jetpack Raw for images on CSS Tricks, even though I'm like an image nerd and want to like do the best that I possibly can. WordPress does such a good job anyway. It does responsive images naturally. You flip on the site accelerator feature, and then there's CDN hosted too. Then you flip on lazy loading, and you get that too, even in browsers that don't support native lazy loading. Incredible image handling just by toggling on a few tabs. Which is amazing. Their instant search feature, which is just launching, they already have a really good thing that you just flip it on and your search gets way better, which I use on CSS Tricks. And I'll be using this instant search feature, which is just takes that feature set and makes it even awesomer. The full page search experience with all kinds of filter toggles and stuff like that. It's going to be awesome. Now I've covered the first two tabs of Jetpack, and there's four tabs to go, so I'm going to stop there for now. Jetpack for WordPress is awesome. This is like the most random thought, because I just did this the other day on our CodePen documentation. It didn't have a left sidebar of all the docs available on it. And I was just looking at the Stripe docs, which of course has that. But you know who else does? Every single other documentation thing ever. And it's not, I mean, maybe it's just a standard thing, you know? But I think it comes from the idea that we all have like VS Code open all day or any other, because that's like the standard developer environment is file system stuff on the left and words on the right.
Yeah. Things to click on the left, things to read on
the right. So I just copied it. I just, because it was, to me, it's just a little templating HTML, CSS change. I'm like, I'm going to do this. It's so stupid that we don't have this, that every other docs have this. So I'm going to do it. I have a question for you, Suze, about over-engineering a Stripe integration, because I think this is a thing that we did historically at CodePen that I like. I think the vibe is that we regret it a little bit. So, for example, like you have customers that pay for stuff, you know, if that's CodePen has pro plans, and you upgrade to them, and then you should be able to within CodePen see some evidence of what happened and look at an invoice and look at the last 4 months of invoices or whatever and see when you upgraded and when you're downgraded. You have all this information about payment history. Like that's kind of the point of having a payment provider, is they help with that. And I think, you know, I don't know if it was just historical or what, I didn't lead up the billing projects at CodePen ever. But, you know, they're not, we look at them and we're like, this isn't as good as it could be. You know, like we have problems with it once in a while. You know, like this is a pain in the butt. And I think what we did was kind of like, oh, when somebody upgrades or changes plans or something, we're going to write it to our own data. We're going to do all the Stripe stuff that we need to do. And we're going to write all that information to our own database. So we have a database that is our our payment stuff that happened database. And lately, the vibe has been like, we should just ditch all that. Like, if you want to show somebody their billing history, just use a Stripe API, get the information from the API, and show it on the screen. That way, the source of truth is Stripe, not your own database. Because things just have a bad habit of getting out of sync for whatever reasons. And our database is just a record. It's not like truth like Stripe is. Like, Stripe's never wrong. Yeah, I mean, maybe there's
we try not to
examples
be. We try to be honest.
But would you like recommend that? I mean, I know that's a pretty like high level weird question. I don't know if it's appropriate or not. But like, when people build billing integrations, would you suggest like not building your own database to track billing historical stuff and just like use the APIs directly all the time?
Chris, it's almost like I paid you to say that, because that's an internal conversation that we're having right now. Like exactly that, and around billing as well. We realize that in our documentation right now, we don't have the best, we really hate being super prescriptive, because we realize every business is different. At the same time, there is a foundational bunch of common scenarios such as this, which come up time and time again, which we get asked about a lot. And so it's an extremely valid question. It's very appropriate. And there is several things around this that I can break down. The first is, yes, that's an actual concern, because you don't want to do any heavy lifting that Stripe can do for you, right? And so, you know, usually at the bare minimum, we recommend that you save the customer number, which is, or the customer ID, which we give you, so that you can then back reference. But at the same time, we don't necessarily want you to hit the Stripe API every time someone logs in or wants to look at their account page to get that fresh information, right? Because it's not as nice of an experience for the user, because you're having to go and fetch this stuff. And then also just hitting our API all the time for that reason is just sort of like, just, you know, feels kind of clunky and awkward. But then you have the problem of, as you said, just having to cache those things on your own side and then having to make sure that those things stay in sync. So what I can talk about right now is that we are working on tools to try and help with that. And the things that you mentioned, such as people being able to view their billing history, being able to update their payment details and things like that, that is something that we're actively looking into right now. So there hopefully should be more news about that. But also we're trying to come up with a way to be able to give recommendations for people such as yourself without being too prescriptive so that you don't, you know, have any foot guns just because, you know, you had this other edge case that we weren't aware of, if that makes sense. So the biggest thing that I can recommend for you right now is webhooks in order to keep your data in sync. And so webhooks can be a little bit weird to learn. Like I know that, Chris, that you're a very established and knowledgeable developer, so you wouldn't have a problem with these, but webhooks can be really great for just being able to listen for when a customer updates something, and then you can sync it back to your end so that you don't have to have all this other, you know, really intense business logic and jumping through hoops and things like that, based on, you know, the customer's business logic that they're going through, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Webhooks are just awesome, period. That's just a nice way to work, I think, for any app. It's nice that you have them.
Yeah, it's a slight non-answer for you. But I mean, at the minimum, you want to store the customer ID, but I understand that you also want more information so that you can show somebody that stuff.
In a way, I want more from the API and less that I have to do. So I'm kind of envisioning structurally, if we were writing this from scratch on day one, you'd have a database that, because you need a little bit on your side. Like if you have paid plans for a website, like if Dave was going to add pro plans to some drawing app he was building or something, the database would have very little in it. It would have a customer ID and would have whether they're paid or not, and like exactly. Maybe like what tier they're on or something, but very little else, you know, not like when they upgraded or what, you know, because that's the stuff that gets out of sync. And all your database needs to know is like, do I need to show this div or not because they're pro or not?
Exactly. Yeah. You've just got to think about what's the bare minimum that the user needs to see. And then I can implement that logic, right? So sometimes users just want to see like the last four of their credit card because they want to log in and be like, oh, I got a new credit card. It has a different number. Do I need to update this account or did I do it last week? I forgot, right? And so if you can just show them the last four, most of the time, unless they've gotten a new expiry date or whatever, but Stripe handles a lot of that for you now. You know, unless they have the same card, different expiry date, they can immediately see if they need to update that. So just bits of magic
even store
are the
that.
Things
Screw
you want
it.
To store. Yeah, exactly. So it really depends on what you want to do for your user. Because yes, you can actually just like completely rely on Stripe for that data and just grab it just in time for the user. But it's really up to like what experience you want to offer for them.
Do people, because now I'm thinking, okay, this database table has customer IDs and whether they're pro or not. Maybe you don't even have tiers. So it's just a Boolean. And the webhooks update it. Like you get a webhook from Stripe that says, oh, their plan expired. Okay, the one turns to a zero then. And so on my end, I can, you know, the user's experience is totally different in my app because they're not pro anymore. That's all I need. But that's so little that it makes me like not even want to have that table. Like it is like, I think that would be like next level for Stripe to be like, you don't have to store anything. You can even ask Stripe if they're pro or not on every page load. I mean, that might be a little heavy API usage, but like, I think that would be cool. It's like, I don't have to code any billing, anything, because it's entirely handled by Stripe.
It is really nice. I mean, unless you have millions of users all logging in at once. So for example, I know that Twitch extensions have this problem because everyone will join an extension, everyone will join a Twitch stream at once, and then that extension just gets hit with a massive load of traffic because it's like a plugin for their Twitch page, right? And so you have to throttle those things. And the reason why that's relevant is because, you know, Stripe has API limits, and so it's approximately 100 a second for reads, 100 a second for writes. So if your users are all going to log in for a specific event on CodePen, that's when that would fall over, right? Because you're going to get a bunch of 429s.
We couldn't do it on CodePen, but for a small scale thing, we could do.
But it's hard to be prescriptive because that's a very valid example of why you wouldn't want to hit the API and rely on it for everything, right? So
plus it's JavaScript only, right? Or is that's not true. Why would I say that? I just think of it that way because we do everything that way.
Yeah, we have other SDKs too on the back end, so.
It just feels weird. It always feels weird to me to hit a third-party API from server-side code in real time, you know? Because then it's like, then the page, the document...
Yeah, it's just crawling.
...doesn't load until,
Yeah, that's the thing.
So here's a hard one for you. Like, this is...
Okay.
Not hard, but
I
like,
love that this is just like CodePen Clinic with Stripe, you know?
Yeah, but then I'll stop. We should talk about other stuff, but I need some advice here. So this is one that's like less, you know, you probably get it all the time, but we'll see. At one point, we decided, I think we're leaving money on the table by not offering PayPal as a payment method to users. Because I think there's certain users, and this was kind of a guess, there's certain users out there that just are like, oh, they don't have PayPal, screw it. This was a lot of years ago. So I don't know if times have changed or what. But we decided, oh, we got to have that, you know? And Braintree is a competitor of Stripe that offers the same kind of stuff. But they're like, oh, Braintree, you're going to, it's amazing. You get Apple Pay and you get credit card stuff too. It's like you should use it, and they're owned by PayPal. So if you want good PayPal APIs, the trick is to use Braintree. But the second you do that, you've really complicated your billing workflow like a lot. Now you have two payment providers you have to deal with, and you have two sets of webhooks, and the APIs are not going to be the same. They're going to be weird, and you're writing middleman stuff, and I don't know. That's another predicament we're in, you know, like it's not terrible, but it's certainly like it's not twice as hard. It's got to be 10x as hard of to deal with two of those things. So, like, do you have like general advice you shell out around that? Is like Stripe for PayPal coming? Probably not.
I don't have a lot to share on this topic. I totally empathize that is absolutely an issue. So Stripe does support Apple Pay and Google Pay. It's like, as you mentioned, like Braintree also supports that. It's just that we don't support PayPal. So that is likely to be like your actual reality that you just described there.
Yeah. Yeah. Not a big deal. I'm just curious because it makes me like, are you actually leaving money on the table if you don't support something like PayPal? Or is that just BS, or is there never an answer to that? Because it totally depends on what your audience is and what they care about.
Yeah, I think that with billing, it's more complicated. Let's say it's just like a one-off donation or something. You can just throw the PayPal button on there, you know, as like an embed or whatever, and try to see and do a test to see how many you get. But short of actually re-implementing all of that just to try it, and then only to have to get stuck with managing that, if you get like three payments, and then now you feel like that's grandfathered in because those people are going to be on those payments forever. It is a really tough problem to solve because you don't know, right? Whereas other payment options, such as like, let's say you're on Stripe and you want to tick the Apple Pay box, you want to tick the Google Pay box, and then you want to tick XYZ country, you can just kind of trial that country and it doesn't actually cause any extra work for you. You know what I'm saying? But the PayPal issue definitely causes that extra work for you because you're actually writing the code to implement it.
I really like that advice, though. I like that advice of like just like as a test, like make it available, but not for real. Like just with a little, this is a little like pay now button where it's, I don't know, maybe it's only your annual plan or something, and you can do it that way.
Or you could be a little bit naughty, and I'm not actually recommending this, but I know that there is a practice in the industry, again, I'm not necessarily recommending it, where people will just put a button and then it will just go to it'll have a quick modal saying, sorry, that's not available right now or something, and then you just see how many times people click on it.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's just a slight inconvenience for the user, so it's a little controversial, but it's just like doing a little bit of research to see like how many people actually clicked on this.
And whatever. There may be some degree of sketchiness to it, but let's set that aside for a second. What it doesn't do is like, let's say it actually super, like that's just their first instinct is to click that thing. But like, would they have upgraded or not? You know, like what you want to know is people that can only pay that way, or that would absolutely walk away if that's not on the table. Because we can look at our numbers now and be like, hey, it's X percentage PayPal and Y percentage Stripe. So that means if we got rid of PayPal, that X percentage is gone. That's not true, because I'm certainly some chunk of those people that pay with PayPal would have paid some other way. They just chose not to because we equally support both, you know?
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of we do Shop Talk kind of via PayPal, but like I have a lot of like, you know, kind of fluid cash, that discretionary income, we'll call it, in my PayPal, that I just like, it's like, oh, I want a keyboard. Guess what's in my PayPal? Okay, I can do a keyboard. You know, it's like, So I'm probably in that camp that would want to just, oh, I'll just use PayPal because that's where all the money's already at. But I'm also in that like, oh, if, like they click the upgrade button, they're probably like, they don't care. You know, they got the credit card out anyway. Yeah. They just want it to come out the right amount every month. They don't really care which service.
The real answer here. Yeah. Is for Stripe and PayPal to just be super friends, get together, port all the data over to Stripe, all the APIs work the same way. It's going to be great. It's coming next year. Just kidding. It's totally not, I'm sure. But
there's this new standard.
Yeah.
You know, as per XKCD, right? There's this new standard that we're all working on, and that's going to be the one that saves us all, right? Yeah, that's exactly what got us here in the first place.
Don't even contribute to the old stuff because the new stuff's coming. The new stuff's going to be here.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is also brought to you by XTeam. That's x-team.com/ShopTalkShow. XTeam allows you to work from anywhere for the world's leading brands and get supported to do more of what you love as a developer. Maybe you haven't heard of XTeam before, but XTeam is a 100% remote company that helps companies scale their development teams by providing them with extraordinary teams of developers from around the world. They believe in living a life of freedom that allows developers, that's you, to spend more time getting energized by your passions. They fostered a unique active lifestyle and culture around this idea that continues to attract thousands of developers to apply every day. XTeam is the most energizing community for developers in the world. What separates XTeam from their competition is the level of attention and care they give to their developers. They proactively support them, fund their learning and growth, and connect them in roaming hacker houses around the world, and then give them a remote environment that motivates and inspires them on a daily basis. Where other companies simply place and drop their talent, they foster and cater to their unified team of developers centered around the same beliefs, values, and lifestyle. So check out XTeam if you'd like the chance to work with big brands like Riot Games, Fox Broadcasting, Kaplan Incorporated, Coinbase, Beachbody, and more. You get to live and work in one of their roaming hacker houses, X outposts they call them, around the world. It changes locations monthly, allowing you to explore and work remotely in the most beautiful locations. You'll get to take part in adventures, share passions, and learn how to be a better remote developer. You'll get to take part in one of the most energizing community for developers in the world by participating in their Seasons, a three-month experience filled with challenges, rewards, games, competitions, and more, all centered around a theme that will inspire and energize you. And you'll get $2,500 per year to spend on doing more of what you love and staying energized. Use it on conferences, courses, video games, photography equipment, and more. So if your developer is looking for a chance to try out remote work, visit x-team.com/ShopTalkShow and find out more. Our thanks to XTeam for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show.
Can we talk about streaming for a minute? You're into that, right?
Yeah, we can talk about that.
Well, I just, what is your, like, why are you into it? What do you do there? And tell me about streaming, period.
Yeah, I think it was 2016. I saw my friend Nolan Lawson stream himself working on PouchDB. And PouchDB is like huge open source library, right? And I contribute open source libraries too, but they're very small, SMOL, and they don't, you know, they don't have a huge user base, but they're very useful to the people who use them. Does that make sense? It's like the quality over quantity rather than quality and quantity. And so I was so fascinated watching him maintain open source because I was like, what is it like to have a really stressful project? I wouldn't even know what that was like. And so I loved watching that. And I said to him, people always, you know, feel intimidated about the hardware SDKs that I write, and that's mostly what I write, and it especially was at the time. But I'm just writing JavaScript at the end of the day. Like, do you think if I streamed this, people would, like, the penny would drop and they would get it, and then they would want to maybe contribute and, like, or they would not put me on a pedestal as much because I really don't enjoy that. And he's like, yeah, you'd be surprised. I think his comment was literally, you'd be surprised at what people would watch. So I did a stream.
That's like ominous and cool.
I know. Well, let's keep it just about development. But yeah, it was a very funny comment. And I thought, well, you know, I'm definitely a homebody. I don't do a lot on the weekends. And so I thought, well, what if I just turn a webcam on, use a pair of Apple you know, headphones and just do it. And I like rehearsed it the night before and was like, I can't make a single mistake and I'm going to like have everything perfect and things like that. And it was really fun. And I had like 9 people, I think, join. And that's because I put it on Facebook and a bunch of social media. So it was really my friends and family just like going along with it to make me feel better, right? But it kind of grew from there and it became much more about why I initially did it. And, you know, I don't rehearse it anymore, but I do have a sophisticated setup that just allows me to record and go, which is very cool.
I will say you're one of my favorite streamers. Just you're in the chill stream camp. It's very chill stream. You're not like, dudes, check out my project. You know, it's great. but one thing I always cite about your stream is you're doing open source, right? But I feel, and maybe it's my fault, but like maybe I have to go do something else on Sunday mornings or whatever. But, you know, I feel like a lot of your stream is just like managing pull requests. Mm-hmm. Like you spend about a good hour of the 2-hour stream or whatever, however long you do it, like just looking over PRs. And I think that's really awesome for 2 reasons. Like that's open source. Like I think people think it's this like glorious, like I'm just slaying code, like, you know, just bashing it out. I wrote a bash script to write code for me or whatever, you know, but it's like, okay, let's see. So this is, they PR'd this. Okay, well, yeah, that looks good. And then you just merge it. And it's just, and then you add a Bitmoji or whatever. And I just think that's like I think that's awesome. And I feel like you really harness like good open source maintainership. And I find that very wonderful. So thank you.
Is that what it mostly is? Is it, or all is this open source maintenance? Is that the spirit of the stream?
I think Dave's right. Like Dave clearly watches my stream. Like, so I totally believe he watches my stream. That's exactly what it's like. We also have like 20 minutes of chit chat at the beginning. We're like, what did you do this week? And like, look at this cool swag I got, you know, and look at this cool like website that I made. But other than that, yes, that's actually been the evolution. So the delightful thing is, you know, I started this stream because I wanted people to be less scared about perhaps contributing. And now I actually just have so many contributions that happen. And what I mean by so many is, you know, like 2 or 3 a week, which is enough to fill an entire hour of looking at stuff, right? And explaining it and understanding the code, maybe pulling it down and manually testing it. And some people will open it on Saturday night because my stream is on Sunday morning. And I'm like, I see what you did there. You're sort of getting one in for the queue, right? You're queuing it up.
Trying to get on the show.
Which okay, I love. Yeah. So it didn't, I actually used to just predominantly write code for 2 hours. And now I do much less of that because other people are writing code for me. And so that's actually really fun. And then if I'm not merging pull requests, sometimes I'm getting issues open of actual bugs. And then we just sit there and laugh at my bug. Like I'll say, oh, I know exactly what this is. Let's pull down the code and let me show you. And let me show you the exact line that this is happening that I wrote 4 years ago that I knew would eventually be a problem. And now it is, right? And so we also just like make fun of past mistakes, and then we have this lovely kind of chill, satisfying feeling of fixing them as well. So I would agree that these days it's less me like, you know, churning out like, you know, code like beast mode, if that makes sense, like much as I roll my eyes at that. It's more about the collaboration side of things, which I didn't expect to happen, but that's been a nice accident.
So you heard it here. Sunday mornings. Watch.
Yeah, it's Sunday morning entertainment. I mean, for me, it's hard because like kids and whatever, you know, it's interrupted time at that time. But it's like just very like cool just because it's just, hey, this is good vibes. And it's like the, I don't know. And you'll do some stuff about like, I feel like you do some, because it's all hardware. And we should probably say that too. It's like not just a coding stream. It's like coding JavaScript for Arduinos, basically, mm-hmm. right? Is that which I'm also interested in, and that's why I watch. But and I have tons of questions. But I think that, do you find it trouble? Like, is it hard to like show kind of what a Arduino's doing, like on your stream? Like, you know, because now you're just physical. It's not just code. It's like I'm trying to get this light to show up or whatever.
Yeah, sometimes that happens. I do still get comments a lot in chat. Because like Twitch has like a live chat, you can, you know, ask questions in if people haven't actually seen a live stream before. And people will still say, I have no idea what you're doing, but I'm like happy to watch. And so that to me says that it's still, there's still kind of like a breakdown of understanding there. You know, I usually, if I'm running anything on Arduino, I'll hold it up to the webcam or have a second webcam because I'm trying to explain what's happening. And I do have some chat macros so that if people say, what is this library or what does it do? I can just like do a quick little command and it'll do an explanation for them so that we don't have to like drop everything. But it's still hard to, I guess, communicate that virtually, if that makes sense. And for those who haven't ever really, for those who aren't even familiar with concepts such as like input-output pins, you know, which is totally like, it's very normal to not be familiar with that stuff if you never have to touch hardware. Just explaining that on a basic level, you know, requires a lot of backing up and just, you know, talking about binary and things like that, which is really interesting.
Is there a good start point for like getting into like programming chips with JavaScript? I have like one of those, whatever, SparkKit Inventor Arduinos or whatever. It's pretty cool. Or Spark, is that what it is? Yeah. But I like it and I did all the, but it's more like, that's more like, is it Java based or something? But it's like you're typing like more C code style stuff, or Arduino code. But I want to write JavaScript on these things. So how do I get started into that realm of hardware?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the good thing is that the ecosystem is so wide and large and varied now that you can get away with doing that quite a bit. There are a couple of options for you. You can buy a microcontroller that's able to run JavaScript. So for example, the Tesla is one of those. The Tesla 2 runs Linux, and you program on your regular computer, which is nice because you have your whole IDE set up and all of your stuff. And then it can just deploy that code over to your Tesla 2, which is really fun. It's small enough that you can pretty much pull off most projects with it. I think it's a better out-of-the-box experience than a Raspberry Pi. You know, a lot of people say, what's the difference between a Raspberry Pi and a Tesla? It's just that the Tesla is just specifically very good at running your JavaScript for you, and it doesn't do anything more. And, you know, it's the abstractions are a little bit better. The other option you have is if you're comfortable learning Lua, which is very similar to JavaScript, there's a bunch of boards out there that can run Lua, such as Expressive.
Expressive, like IF at the end? Expressive.
Yes. Yes, it's Expressive.
Is that more, you know, from the world I live in, I would think, everybody just wants the JavaScript board, but is that language just as popular or more in this world?
Yeah, I think if you have like if you have an ESP8266, that is a bunch of numbers and letters, but that's a very common microcontroller that you can actually put Lua on. And so I was trying to find the different brands that actually make that a little bit easier, but people prefer that just because the boards are a lot less expensive. So if you go to AliExpress or a super discounted web store like that, you can get those things for $5, and they have like all the pin breakouts and everything that you would want. But you don't have to like, and they're a lot smaller too. So if you have a really small project and you want to be able to like do a lot in a small little footprint, they can be actually a better option for you. They're just more resource constrained. They're not running Linux, and your code, depending on like the architecture, is either actually running Lua or with an interpreter, or it's actually compiling it down to a totally different thing. Like it could be compiling it down to assembly instead. So
that's wild. So the Tesla 2 does run Linux, and a ESP8266 does.
That's kind of how it is. It's basically like, what do you want your abstractions to be? What do you want your size to be? And what's your budget? It's just like every other tool that you're choosing, right? It's like, what are your variables?
All the hobbies,
yeah.
Right?
What are your variables? What do you want? And I think the hardest thing with hardware is that there's so many things that you don't necessarily know what questions to ask, and you don't know what you want. So what's helpful is finding someone such as me to just like walk you through the basic questions, you know, and then give you a recommendation.
Okay. Can I pitch an idea? This is going to be my whole friggin' retirement startup, but here's my idea. Can you help me? I want an Arduino that's connected to the internet. And whenever somebody assigns a GitHub issue to me, a thermal printer will print out a ticket, almost like a short order cook. So every time I get assigned an issue, I get a little piece of paper that's like, "Hey, you got an issue," and I rip it off and I pin it to
one of those spinny with the spring on it.
Yeah, with the spinny like roof.
What's going on there? Like, what do you got there?
Is that something you already have built?
Yeah, so I have a thermal printer that I'm actually holding up. So those listening at home won't actually see that, but we're on video chat. And you can actually do this in the browser now. If you wanted to, you could have a backend JavaScript webhook that does that for you. And there's some really good Node.js thermal libraries out there, thermal printer libraries. Okay. But you can also do it in the browser. So like I did like a Game Boy camera, Game Boy printer, you know, emulation, not emulation, but like a web version. And you can actually connect to one of these thermal printers with either Bluetooth or USB, and you can use web Bluetooth or web USB. So absolutely, you can do that like right now.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I'll have to get the SKU there on the thermal printer. And
so in your house, you could just like glue it to the wall and it's got Wi-Fi. So it's hooked up to your router, I guess. And how does it, just because it has Wi-Fi, does that mean it's also does it take a webhook then? Or how do you like?
So it doesn't have Wi-Fi, but this is where you could have, you could get one of those ESP8266s, basically set up an access point and a webhook on it. And then you just send it the string that you want to print. And that would be very quick. But again, Bluetooth and USB tends to be quite common. You might be able to find a Wi-Fi one, which makes it way easier, but it's harder to lock it down security-wise,
I guess. It requires your computer too. Could you make one that's computer independent?
It's going to depend. Most of the time you need at least like a Raspberry Pi or something like that to to actually do the connection for it. But have you seen the RIP, lots of tears about this, but did you ever see the Berg Cloud Little Printer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, I forget where it, so it, it, did it come out and then it like kind of went away? Is that right?
Yeah, it's, I mean, hardware startups are really hard because they cost a lot of money and feedback cycles are very slow. So you have to keep that money and your runway going for a lot longer than software startups. So that one unfortunately went down. I did have one. And what it would do is you would subscribe to feeds such as, you know, I want a daily poem today, or I want the weather. And then it would print you out a little report every morning, and it was the cutest thing ever. And you could send each other pictures too, and it would just print the pictures out. And it was the best thing. Oh, and it had a little modem that you plugged into your router, and that was basically the little computer that would securely talk to the printer. So it would be a very similar setup to that, if that makes sense.
It does. So it could, somebody could have bought this thing who doesn't have a computer at all and still make it work, maybe?
Yeah, it was the most adorable thing ever. And they ended up open sourcing their backend cloud server. So people have gone and re-implemented it and hosted it, and their little printers are living on, which is adorable.
Yeah. It's sad that it's a cool URL too, littleprinter.com, and it just spins and spins. Somebody just didn't even renew the domain name. Sad.
It's adorable. Friggin' adorable. You sent daily puzzles?
It was the best. And then it would stop. It would print. Like the paper would go behind this face silhouette cutout, and every time it stopped printing, it would print the face and then feed it through so that the face was showing again on the printer. And that was its like default. Just the details in it were so beautiful that it did actually make me excited about thermal printers. That's why I went out and bought one, and I've been playing with them for years ever since. So.
Oh man, I wonder, I want this. I would love like a little analog-y side of things, you know, just that's because I don't know. Like, I feel like specifically with like GitHub issues or whatever, maybe this is good for your stream too. But like, you know, it's like when it's all digital, you're just like, dude, I don't know which issue was that? What, where was that? I have no idea. But if you had a little like, I don't know, little thing with a little, I don't know, QR code to the issue or something.
No, this is the kind of IoT that I absolutely love. It's like little tiny augmentations. I think that I prefer those kinds of things. I would also recommend Adafruit has like a clone. They have like a do-it-yourself version. They don't obviously reference the little printer, but it's like a kit with laser cut plastic and you put the thermal printer in to make it look prettier. And so, yeah, if you Google Adafruit, Adafruit, they have like a couple of kits and they have tutorial that walks you through it. And if it's just Python, you can, you know, swap that out for JavaScript if you want. But they have a lot of Python libraries that they do for that kind of stuff.
That's cool. I'll have to try to, yeah, here we go. All right, I'm just going to get the old credit card. I'm spending this old,
No. PayPal
bucks. Yeah, my Stripe bucks.
Yeah. We should be able to have a personal. I thought that'd be cool to have a pay with Stripe button where it was like your Stripe account, not like a credit card. But
yeah, with me, Stripe Bucks is like a joke we have internally because we don't have that. We're just like, oh, just use my Stripe Bucks. But yeah, it doesn't really exist.
So we just have a little time left. I thought it'd be interesting to, you are, you know, it was 6 months at Stripe now and 2.5 years or something like that at Microsoft before that. Also DX, and you mentioned Kickstarter before that. Bounced around to a lot of big places. But yeah, at one point you were like a just straight up front end, right? And now X
front. Yeah, I was a front end developer for 12 years and, you know, like would just have to inherit different back end languages as I went along too, because, you know, let's be real, like a front end developer still has to edit Ruby sometimes and things like that. So yeah, I was, and then I just kept being promoted to tech lead or promoted to like be quote unquote the responsible one on the team. And it was mostly because I was just angry that like we weren't focusing on the user, or I was just angry that I was like, this matters for our experience as developers, but we're actually making it a ton worse for the user by choosing ourselves and prioritizing ourselves in this case. And I would just get angry all the time. And I would want to fix things. And whenever I went on run or on call, I was like, yes, this is my time to fix all the things that I wasn't allowed to fix. And so that made me think maybe developer advocacy would be better for me because I'm clearly passionate about this. And maybe I will feel like I can actually have a better impact by, my job is literally to be persuasive about this stuff full time. And so that's why I wanted to try doing that, because, you know, the worst feeling in the world to me is when someone tries to run one of my libraries and it just blows up immediately and then they blame themselves. And I just want people to not feel like that. So that was sort of why I moved. I just got so outraged by just this navel gazing that sometimes developers do. And I felt like I was the only one on the team that was actually thinking about the fact that we were shipping something to users and that they're the ones that are important, you know. And I'm not saying that everyone's like that, but it was just a common theme that I was the outlier on every team who was like getting furious about this stuff.
And now you're at a company that has friction logs. So I guess you win.
It's like the best feeling. I can't even tell you how good it is when people are like, yes, we want you to tell us. And also, if we don't have time to do it, you can just go ahead and pull request it and we'll accept it. And I'm like, yes, this feels so good.
That's wonderful. Well, speaking of not having time, I know we have some hard stops here. This is another hard stop edition of Shop Talk. So we should wrap up. But thank you so much for coming on. This ticks a lot of boxes for stuff I wanted to talk about. So thank you. And but for people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
Don't worry about giving me money. I think that I'm in a very privileged position being a developer. But you can definitely find me online through one basic social media handle, which is NoopCat. You can call me NoopCat as well. It doesn't really matter how you pronounce it, but that's NOOPKAT.
All right. And Twitch stream Sunday mornings, if you're still doing that, I assume. Mm-hmm. Hadn't changed, but Sunday mornings on Twitch. There you go. And you can do bits.
Bits are fun.
Well, cool. All right. Well, thank you very much. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcast, your choice. Be sure to star our favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for 10 tweets a month. If you hate your job, head over shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.